Okay, happy new year. Welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I'm your host, Jennifer Udden. I can say my own name.
Okay, Judden.
The incoherent noises you're hearing are me transforming into some kind of monster and laying waste to this office.
Jen hulks out. And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
Happy New Year. Cheers.
Happy New Year.
Clink. So yeah.
2016 is over. We have set it on ceremonial fire and disposed of it.
And unfortunately, the ceremonial fire has caught onto 2017 and is continuing.
Yes.
You know, in the past week alone, we've had president-elect possibly into water sports, definitely into treason.
Yes.
We've had a YA book about a Nazi fetus, which I'm still not entirely sure I understand.
I confess I haven't actually seen anything about this.
I saw the cover and I was just like, I felt like Homer Simpson just like fading backwards into the bushes, just like, nope. Nope.
I feel like whenever anything happens on Twitter these days, I see the like, I don't see the rock splashing into the lake. I don't see the ripples, the source of the ripples. I just see, like, small waves and, like, what's going on?
I see the people on the shore going, like, what? What are those ripples? What's happening?
And I'm just like, and I don't know what the solution to that is.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm just like, I don't want to dive in and find out what's going on. I'm just going to turn off Twitter and go back and do my work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that is very fair. I went from not being on Twitter at all over the holidays and after the election to like in the last 2 days, just like retweeting all the things. Like my entire feed is probably retweets right now. I actually like reinstalled it so I could complain about a line at the airport, which I feel is like the worst thing to do. But
first world problems,
Jen. Oh my God. It was ridiculous. I felt ashamed of myself afterwards. But in all fairness, my flight was canceled later that day, so I feel
it was
so
a pretty bad travel.
Yeah.
What is Twitter for except to have some, if not to have someone to complain about travel mishaps to?
Yeah, yeah.
No one person wants to hear all your complaints and have to respond to them.
Yeah.
Just broadcast them to the universe.
Exactly. Well, we had a question on Twitter that I feel is a really good one and which is probably a good sort of jumping off point slash thematic entry into what we normally do at this time of year, which is sort of like, it's a new year, goals, resolutions.
Yeah.
One moment, please. The problem is I've been liking so many things out of just like fucking anxiety that it's just like, okay.
See, this is why I don't like anything on Twitter. Because I only use it to save things I want to see again.
Yeah.
Which means the changing it to a heart actually kind of annoyed me.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, if you're going to have a like function, you need to have a separate, like, favorite preserve function.
Yeah, I think that that's something that I would want to talk about later. Our friend Nora McLaughlin asks, she's Nora Stories on Twitter, any advice for folks who need to be on Twitter professionally but are finding it panic-inducing right now?
Oh, if only I could figure that out.
I think we all are looking for that question. And Bridget's suggestion for the theme for the episode was, you know, how to be creative and productive in a time of blind, screaming anxiety.
Yes.
And I was like, I would love to know the answer to that if you figure it out.
Yes. I was talking to Kate Sullivan, who's an editor at Delacorte. And by talking, I mean tweeting. And so she was tweeting about how she was having a really good editing day. She was like really focused and really intent and doing really good work. And then her ex-boyfriend called her to see when he could drop off like a box of her stuff. And she was like, and now it's completely gone. I can't focus on this anymore.
You've told me this story before, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have I told it on the podcast?
I think you may have, but that's fine. I've told like the same story like 6 times, so
yeah.
I'm sure.
So in case you missed whatever previous episode where I told this story, so she's, you know, complaining on Twitter about how for now she is, her work day is ruined and she's sort of like in emotional upheaval. And I'm like, those are connected. It's really hard to do creative feeling work when all you can feel is like horror and sadness.
Well, and what this reminds me, like, I think that there's two things sort of at work that I try to keep reminding myself of. And the first is that Twitter is not information.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter is talking.
Yes.
That may sometimes link to information, but Twitter in and of itself is not information. And I actually have had to force myself to start reading the actual news.
Okay.
Like, I force myself to read the news in the morning and, like, you know, periodically throughout the day. Because I feel like the more I go on Twitter and sort of see the talking, the more freaked out I get. Whereas the New York Times, you know, just sort of, here's the facts. Here's, you know, what's going on.
Interpretation of them. But
well,
like,
yeah, but
just,
I mean,
one interpretation.
Exactly. But it's not just sort of like, we're all gonna die. Everything is garbage. Do I need to start hoarding food? You know, like, I feel like, especially in my corner of the internet, we've all gotten kind of hysterical.
Yep.
And, like, and I don't say that in any way to belittle the actual,
no,
you know, the actual factual things that are coming down the pike.
Yes.
But at the same time,
I frequently feel that while also sitting alone quietly by myself, I feel like the hysteria.
Yeah. But I feel like Twitter, like, feeds into it.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's one thing. And then the second thing is I have had to really do some very hard looking at the things that I call self-care. Because, yes, it is taking care of my immediate emotional needs to watch 12 hours of Criminal Minds.
I certainly don't think about how sad I am.
But it is certainly not caring for my future self when I do that instead of, say, sleeping.
Yes.
Not that that happened in the last 4 days.
It's like, but sleeping, exercising, eating real food, and not
doing
just
doing my
looking.
Job, yep. You know, and like calling my fucking congressman and stuff, which I hate, but which I'm doing. You know, it's just, I feel like we sort of, like, as a generation are just sort of like, and we need to sort of like change that to like some kind of primal scream of rage. Exactly. And it's so, I mean, it's so stupid, but like, I really think that that's the case.
Yeah.
Like, I think we all spend a lot of time talking.
Yeah.
I say this, you know, because I'm absolutely guilty of this, but like,
and I think that that's one of the things that is good about Twitter at this point is people, I see retweeted into my feed a lot action items.
Oh yeah,
like,
definitely
things to do. Here's a concrete step you can take today to make things better. Yeah. I appreciate that, thank you.
Well, one thing I've noticed, and you know, let me know if this is something that you have seen too, is that I see a disproportionate number of the sort of like helpful posts of like action items, like calls to action. I see them coming from members of marginalized groups and the people I follow who are like white and white cishet sort of more privileged people are sort of retweeting them but not doing anything, like not saying anything about it. And I wonder if that sort of is just sort of part of a larger pattern of like not speaking up for what we believe in. Like, when people yell at Debbie Reese for saying stuff that is 100% true, or, like, come for Justine Ireland for saying stuff that is 100% true.
Yeah.
And then, you know, white authors kind of, like, either retweet it or just, like, don't say anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I do wonder if it's also linked to the idea that rather than talking over marginalized people, you should boost their voices.
Yeah.
And I think that that is often what the instinct is. It's like, I am not going to repeat what this person said. I'm going to make sure more people see it. But the counter side of that is the more retweets you get, the more likely you are to wind up in troll territory.
Exactly. And I feel like, I don't know, I have so many feelings and like so few of them are good. But, yeah.
So, what are we doing to combat this? I am trying to, because I know that I will find myself just sitting on Twitter scrolling through the existential despair and the things that need to be done for hours. I will like lie on my bed and scroll through Twitter. So I've had to put up some very concrete blocks to like limit the amount of time I can spend on these things and instead, you know, live a life worth living. I'm really trying to focus on that and doing a good job at my job and a good job at my life Because the one thing people talk about a lot is these are distraction tactics.
Yeah.
If we make you so terrified you can't do anything other than scream and cower, you're not doing the good things. You're not living your own life.
Yeah. Didn't Toni Morrison say that? That, you know,
maybe.
I'm really ashamed that I don't remember this, but like discussions of racism and like racist action is a distraction from the work that you, I mean, I don't know if I like 100% agree like with that, but like, you know.
Yeah. Every new person.
As a white person, I don't think that I have a say in that, but, you know, but I think that that's true. And I think that, you know, it is hard to, you know, in the face of this insanity to remind ourselves that this is something that they want.
Yes.
You know? I always joke, like, the terrorists are winning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, like, I was telling Bridget as I was walking in today, you know, I actually weirdly feel better in the last couple of days because knowing that water sports is a thing that the president-elect had to deny in some kind of ridiculous badly art-directed press conference is, like, weirdly making me feel better. Because, like, no matter what happens,
that's
always going to be a thing that has happened, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, not that he isn't also, like, a nightmare fascist, but he's a nightmare fascist that enjoys watching people pee. So.
So, that is a thing that we can...
I mean, it's sort of the obligatory, like... I don't want to kink shame anybody, but like,
no, it's
when your kinks are like water sports and treason, it's like
treasonous water sports. That's all I'm condemning.
I want only 100% red blooded American water sports,
patriotic water sports.
That is the title of the episode right there. Patriotic water sports, episode 35 of Shipping and Handling.
I hope my mother is not listening to this episode.
Oh my god, my poor mother. Uh-oh. Yeah, we all had a time at Christmas, just like kind of sitting around in like abject horror, just going like, "Well, yes. Our relatives are dying, and Trump is president."
Great. This is a great reality we live in.
Yeah, basically. But I feel like, you know, so what are the things besides sort of setting boundaries for yourself? What are the things that you are trying to do or tell yourself, you know, on a regular basis to kind of get you through the day?
Silence. You know,
I'm leaving that pause in. When I, it's like,
na, 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 na. You know, I am trying to do the, like, do things that I don't necessarily want to do. Like, I mean, this is always the thing, but, you know, I shouldn't skip out on the gym just because I don't really feel like going to the gym. So mm-hmm. I'm going to go and I'm going to take care of myself.
Especially since our healthcare is going away.
Yes.
Although it's not. That's the thing. It's like,
yeah.
This is what I've been trying to do is, like, whenever I catch myself, you know, wanting to make fatalistic jokes about, like, you know, when our healthcare is destroyed.
Mm.
It's like, well, I mean, I'm not like the secret type person. But I honestly feel like if I talk like that, I'm going to feel like it's going to be true and I'm going to do less to prevent it.
That's a good
point.
Does
that make sense? Like, I feel like that, even though I don't want it to happen, I feel like by saying it kind of in a jokey way.
Yeah.
I'll like.
It's normalizing.
Exactly. I mean, how many times did people say like, haha, Trump, ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, before the election. And I was just like, don't fucking say that because he's going to be the fucking nominee. You dumbasses. You know, so I feel like, you know, we're not going to lose affordable health care. We're not going to lose the Affordable Care Act because we can't. And no. I can't talk like that.
And there were a lot of things, especially today, because my understanding of what has been going on in Congress the last few days is that the Democrats are introducing things that the Affordable Care Act covers in order to try to get them passed so they're still in place.
Right.
If the Affordable Care Act is repealed. And those have all been voted down. They haven't yet done anything
about
the actual act.
And they have
need more
until,
votes
like,
for that.
January 27th or something is like some deadline.
Okay.
And I feel like the other thing is like, I don't think that I or many of the people I know have a good enough understanding of how the government works.
No. It's most of
isn't that horrifying?
I had a reasonable civics class when I was in high school.
I had a great, I had a great government teacher. I had a he taught AP US history.
Yeah,
like wonderful.
And pretty much everything else I know comes from watching The West Wing,
which is sort of like
it's yes.
I watched the first like 15 episodes and I was like, I want to keep going, but I also want to stop.
I was rewatching it before the election to remind myself that there were still people in government who wanted to do the work and who were willing to talk to each other about mm-hmm. those things, and just trying to reassure myself that it feels like everything is falling apart, but actually things aren't entirely falling apart. But once the election happened, I had to stop. I quit halfway through season six. I was like, I can't do this anymore.
But I think that, you know, because I don't have a good sort of current understanding of how the government works and how these things happen, it is easy to imagine things falling apart. But mm-hmm. then I think, you know, it's a huge fucking bureaucracy.
Yes. Everything moves slow.
Everything moves slowly. And I think, honestly, that the incoming insane GOP mm-hmm. people and the incoming president-elect are going to run into that hard truth, you know?
I very much hope so.
Like, I really...
I hope that the sheer incompetence...
Well, that... But I think that also it's because... the things that we do to slow them down, like mm-hmm. calling our congresspeople, calling our senators, writing letters, right, mm-hmm. you know, calling the Office of Ethics or whatever, calling the Oversight Committee, like, you know, we make that happen as mm-hmm. much as the inertia of government makes that happen. So. Yes.
And, you know, every time you call them, they have to, someone has to stop what they're doing and deal with the phone.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, I mean, and it's not even that. It's just, you know, they've got, you know, minions that, whose job it is to mm-hmm. man the phones, or woman the phones, in the case maybe, or person the phones, you know, depending on your preference. But
staff the phones.
Staff the phones, yes. And, you know, I think that I allowed myself, like, any kind of recrimination I have for the left is really directed at myself, because, like, mm-hmm. I know I didn't speak up as mm-hmm. much as I could have.
Yeah. Like, I could have done more, but I feel like that's...
Well, no, it's not that yeah. I could have done more. It's that I don't do things regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's fair. And I think that is... The one silver lining that I am taking out of all of this is that everyone is involved now.
Yeah.
So many more people...
We're in it.
So
We're
many
in
people
it.
Who had never done anything yeah. before are now like, okay, this is...
Well, as long
I'm doing
as it,
this now.
As long as it stays that way, I worry sometimes that, like, our narrative about political engagement is sort of like The Biggest Loser, where, like, you're either on the ranch and you're, like, you know, camping out in front of Congress 24/7, or yeah. you're, like, on the couch not doing anything. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
we have this kind of, I feel like there is this kind of reality TV, like, fake, like, not fake urgency, but, like, urgency narrative, like, call right now. Like, if you don't do this, you're terrible. Like, if, you know, blah, blah, yeah. blah. And it's like, we all just need to kind of take a step back, take a deep breath, get some prescriptions for Xanax before we can't get them anymore, and, like, use that to, like, power through and call. Like,
yeah. The other thing that I think about a lot is, so every time there's an emergency, there's always the call for blood. There's yeah. always, and then you wind up with these huge lines of people who are donating blood, and it's taking forever, and like you, and that happens. But they you can only keep, the shelf life of blood is 4 weeks, 6 weeks.
Yeah. After 9/11, they actually ended up shipping all the blood everywhere, like
yeah.
elsewhere.
Yeah. It's you can't just show up when they call for it immediately. You have to go every 2 months and
give blood
and even and don't go in the day after the emergency. Go a month later when all those people who gave can't give anymore and they're running and the blood is yeah. going bad.
Yeah.
So yeah. it's part of sharing the work and spacing it out
yeah.
and not just diving on what needs to be done immediately, but figuring out what the next step is.
Yeah. Someone, I forgot, I think it was on Tumblr, someone actually posted a really good idea for, like, especially for people who maybe freelance or are more mobile, like, hosting kind of like a call-in where, like, you say, okay, everyone come over to my apartment. I'm going to have scripts, or come over to my office. I'm going to have, like, scripts made out, and mm-hmm. we're going to call our people, and we're going to call our congressmen, like, all at once.
Nice.
Because that's a way to do it, especially, like, if you have anxiety about, like, making phone calls, as so many of us do. You know, it's something you can do, like, together and stuff like that.
And it's less you just sitting alone with your phone and the stranger on the other end.
Oh, my God. Although, actually, I think I've only gotten through once.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I call, I've left a couple of voicemails, and I have a couple of scripts that I follow. I think I got through once, and I was just like, oh, hi. I forget who it was on the other line, but they were just like, you sound surprised to have reached a person. I was like, I am, actually. I've been trying for, like, 10 minutes.
They're well, like, we're calling in New York.
Yeah.
And everyone in New York is furious.
Yeah, and I have a 713 number, so I have a Houston number. So I call the Texas reps, too.
That's good. I was going to say, like, I could also call Connecticut.
I use a slightly different script because I can't lie and say, like, as a constituent, because I'm definitely not a constituent anymore. Yeah. But I mean, I think to go back a little bit to Nora's original question, you know, using Twitter, you know, as a person who, I mean, there was a really great article that I'll try and link to in the post where someone said, you know, it's really super easy to say, like, just get off the internet. But, like, it's like saying, like, well, just don't go in the water when your job is to be, like, a professional swimmer.
Yeah.
Like, there are sharks in the water. Well, I also need to be in the water for, like, my job.
I'm a lifeguard.
I think that the thing that I would tell my clients if they are in this situation is, you know, like you said, set boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this is the time not only to restrict your usage, but also to, like, look at who you follow.
Yes. I was just going to say a practical tip that came to me while Jen was talking is...
Because I'm smart. I mean, you think of stuff. You're just like, oh my God, Jen's so smart.
The very judicious use of lists.
Oh, yeah.
Create a political list. Create a fun things that will cheer you up list for when you've been looking at the political list for too long.
I'm actually planning on doing that this weekend.
Oh.
In front of my, like, season 12 rewatch of Criminal Minds.
Nice. Very smart. And then also, you know, publishing and writing and things that are...
Yeah.
Specifically about whatever you need to be on Twitter for.
Yeah.
And then you can follow those and... use that to sort of set how you feel. You can look at those rather than the main Twitter feed.
Well, because I think that, especially for me, you know, if it's all in the same feed, it reloads so fast that then I have the anxiety of, like, there's 20 unread tweets and I never get to, like, the bottom. You know, I used to be able to get to the bottom of Twitter because I followed, like, 100 people and they didn't tweet that much. But that's actually something that I'm planning on doing. I think the other thing is actually, the other thing that I would recommend is, I mean, I don't know how she uses Twitter, but I am sort of an overzealous hearter of things.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same on Tumblr. Like, I think I have, like, 10,000 posts on Tumblr and, like, 30,000 likes. And, like, some of it is just stuff that, like, oh, I think this is funny. Or, like, oh, this is, like, this is a heartwarming story. But, like, maybe a third of that is something that I would actually want on my blog. So I think that, you know, my goal going forward is to, like, not just heart something that I agree with, but to actually either engage with it, or if it's something I'm saving for later, to open it in another tab and, like, save the bookmark to read for later. If anyone hasn't heard of Pinboard, it is, like, the best invention of all time. But
interesting,
because it's like, so it's a bookmark, like, program.
Oh, nice.
How many people are texting me right now? It's a bookmark program, but you can save things from the internet and you can tag them as, like, read later.
Oh, okay.
So
useful.
And then once you have, like, read them, you can either save them or you can tag them. And I have the option. I think it's a paid service, but it's like $10 a year. And I actually paid the $25 a year option because then it archives all of my bookmarks. So even if the website goes away, I can still access it.
Fancy.
Because, like, there's a lot of fanfic that gets deleted
that I want to read later.
But so that's my plug for that. But yeah, so that's the thing. It's like boundaries, lists, and engagement, rather than just sort of like, because I also feel sort of, I mean, that's the app is designed for that.
Yes.
I also try to remember that Twitter is, like, not my friend, and it's not the friend to, like, any right thinking person. I mean, it's a friend to a lot of right thinking people.
Alt right thinking.
Ugh, no, I don't use that term. It normalizes Nazis.
No, see, the thing is, my point of view on this is, if you use it enough and clarify what it means, it is actually very helpful to say, like, a specific brand of white supremacy that is cultivated online.
Yeah, that's true.
That is a specific, that is a useful way to use the term.
Yeah.
Because, like, you can't just say they're the Klan, because the Klan is a different thing, and we have a very specific image of the Klan.
And that and is the, called the Klan.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, using it and clarifying what it means is more useful than just not using it at all.
I guess that's true. I guess that's true. I would also say, you know, maybe we shouldn't call white supremacists dapper.
I agree
in
with that.
Profiles.
You know who else was dapper? The Nazis.
Oh,
Hugo Boss designed their uniforms.
Oh, I've told you the story before, right? He designed the uniforms, and then they were so, like, Hitler was so obsessed with aesthetics over, like, utilitarianism that they were wearing, like, wool coats that, like, froze in the winter, like.
Yes, you have.
And the
news.
Pants were so tight that they couldn't sit down. It's like, this makes me so happy. Like, it's like the water sports thing. I'm just like, I'm sorry, like, Captain Tight Pants. Like, we have to laugh. But yeah. So boundaries, engagement, you know, that kind of stuff.
And also, you know, finding the places where you can refill the well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Making sure you take a very deliberate, you make the very deliberate choice to do so. And you find the things that inspire you and make you feel creative and productive. And those things are still coming up. And this happened to me yesterday. There was an article about a woman who had died recently, named Claire Hollingworth.
Oh, the reporter.
Yes.
Yes.
So she was the reporter who broke the story of World War II, like that Germany was invading Poland. She was the first one who did this. And I'm like, that is an incredible story. It is also incredibly timely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is something that there is a wealth of things that you can explore that ties into the emotions that we're all feeling so strongly right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that finding the stories that inspire you to tap into that is one of the best ways to deal with it.
I also think that it's important to recognize that, like, though Twitter is an excellent tool for promotion and for engagement, you do not have to be on it.
Yeah.
And if being on Twitter and feeling like you have to sort of, like, be branding all the time, if that is causing you, like, pain or anguish or, you know, stress, you are absolutely fine in taking a break.
Yep.
You know, just take a step back.
Yep.
Take however long you need and, you know, come back later or don't come back at all. I mean, tools are only useful insofar as they are useful to us. Does that make sense?
Like, yes.
I don't know if that's just, like a tautology.
There are tools we don't use anymore.
Yeah.
There are
telegrams.
Yep. Things that we discard as other things as they become more cumbersome than useful.
Yeah. And I feel like Twitter is kind of edging up onto that.
Yeah.
Because it has so many engagement problems. And also the fact that they refuse to deal with their Nazi problem.
Yes.
Like, the fact that they can say, like, no, you can't use this clip of, like, this NFL game or this clip from the Olympics,
right?
But they can't be like, oh, yeah, those rape threats. That's just, like,
we can't do anything about that. It's free speech.
I'm just like,
Maybe someone should copyright rape threats. Brilliant idea.
How would we go about that?
I don't know. I think you would have to write a book about, like, that was just a serious.
I'd have to make, like, a t-shirt and brand it.
Yeah.
Because they have books. I mean, who respects books?
Obviously.
Although I did read online about some professor somewhere created a Twitter bot that was basically made to combat, like, online anti-Semitism and, like, trolling and sort of that kind of hateful speech. And someone was like, oh my God, it's a golem. Because the golem was...
I love that.
I know, right? Because the
golem... amazing.
The golem was originally created to combat the blood libel, which is this hateful rumor. And I was just like, I love that so much.
That's so great.
I know.
Oh, that's the best.
I was just like, thank you, internet. Like, the internet giveth and the internet taketh. Like, finding these things that sort of make things...
It's like, oh, yes, this.
It's also helpful to, like... I also find it, like, helpful / horrifying to... acknowledge that, like, this has happened before.
Yes.
And one of the reasons I think it happened again is because we thought, like, oh, World War II happened, we beat We beat anti-Semitism. We beat the Nazis. Like, you know, Martin Luther King happened, you know.
Yeah.
We beat racism. Someone on Tumblr was like,
the Cold War ended. We beat Russia.
someone on Tumblr was, you know, doing, you know, like, listen, you should just, like, follow Martin Luther King's example and be nonviolent. It's like, you know what happened to him? He got shot. He got shot by a racist.
Yep.
That's what happened, Martin Luther King. He got fucking shot. So.
Like, yes, now he has a day named after him. But.
But also, voter discrimination.
Yes. So. Also, he could theoretically still be alive. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That was not that long ago.
I know. That's the other thing. It's like, I read the book that won the National Book Award for children's books. What's that called? What's that award called?
Young People's Literature.
Young People's Literature. The representative John Lewis graphic novel. It was really powerful. I was just like, I feel really bad for everyone else who had a book come out that year because nothing else was going to win. My own book included, but like, although she wasn't eligible anyway because she's not American. But
and you know, it's also National Book Award. How can you not award the actual legislator who is writing about his own story?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you're, of course, yeah. Obviously,
yeah.
Like, that's I think everyone called that, and I think also everyone was happy about it.
Yeah, like not mad, not mad about it. It was it was a really good book,
yep.
but it was really powerful because it was, you know, really kind of. I mean, I took a my excellent government teacher taught this class called 1968 in high school, where it was about 1968 and like protests against the Vietnam War and, you know, the civil rights movement and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't think that I really grasped then how much happened and how long it had been going on. Like, you know, I sort of gave myself sort of like the nice white lady pass to like not.
Yeah.
Be inquisitive. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like those, that chart of like, that is like the duration of the United States, and like 2/3 of it is slavery.
Yeah.
And then another like half of what remains is,
Jim Crow.
And then and then there's like this tiny little bit at the end that's like after the civil rights movement. And it's like,
But then there's the new Jim Crow, you know, like...
Like, it has not been a long time, and it has also... It's a very small percentage of our country's history.
Yeah. Well, so, with this, you know, discussion kind of in mind, you know, turning to the yearly thoughts about, you know, goals for the year, and hopes and dreams and, you know, stuff like that, resolutions, do you have any that are kind of informed by... Or, like, has this kind of thing informed the way you think about what you want to do for the year?
I mentioned this in the last episode. I would still like to represent things that have, you know, happy endings, or at least optimistic endings, especially for people who have historically struggled.
Mm-hmm.
Who
don't normally get happy endings.
Yes. Yeah. The people who die very easily in most books. I would like to have at least the possibility of good things, and also ones with, you know, very tangible good things.
Yeah.
I tend to prefer things that are just a little bittersweet. So we're gonna keep that going forward. But I'm also a fan of happy endings.
You're gonna suffer, but you're gonna be happy about it. Okay. Okay, Ron.
And I'd also like to represent things that are sort of evocative of the way that teenagers are feeling now, specifically, because there was something going around several years ago, like in the middle of the dystopian heyday, that was like, why are teenagers so obsessed with it? And it's like, well, global warming, crashed economy, lots of rights being taken away.
Student loans.
Like, yeah, they, as far as they can tell, they're not going to grow up in a pretty nice, in a good world. And so it's, I would like to find a way to address those emotions and also, you know, address how to do something about it. Even if it's not like the dystopian era, I think that maybe it'll come back, maybe it won't. I don't know. But things like, I was reading over Christmas break, Hope Was Here by Joan Bauer, which is probably the first YA contemporary novel I ever actually loved. And it's about a teenage girl whose mother basically abandoned her, handed her over to the mother's sister. And she also named this girl Tulip before abandoning her. And she was like, that is the worst name. So she changed her name to Hope. And she's, you know, she's a diner waitress. Her aunt, who takes care of her, is a chef. And so they wind up in this small town in Wisconsin where the man who owns the diner has leukemia, is a Quaker, and has decided he is going to run for mayor against this corrupt man who runs the town. Mm. And it's this incredibly powerful book about a very, like, small stakes but huge emotions local election, and it's about the kids who get involved in this and the teenagers who can't vote but are spending their days fighting for this man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an absolutely wonderful book, and I think that that is the kind of thing where it doesn't need to be about sort of everything being as bad as it is in order to touch on something that really matters.
Well, it's sort of like what we were talking about earlier with, you know, the all or nothing narrative. Like, it has to be the death of the world, or it has to be, you know, no one's doing anything. Like, finding that power in smaller stories.
The other thing that I really like about this
is recognizing that what we think of as a small story isn't necessarily a small story.
Yes, yes. The other thing I really like about this is it doesn't have a special, like, chosen one narrative, which I think it's easy to sort of feel like to believe that there is someone who is, you can fall into this thing where you think that someone else will save you, because that's what happens in the books. And this one, it's, you know, they, all of them get on the streets and do the thing that is necessary. And so I think that that is really helpful as well.
Yeah.
What about you, Jen?
Well, you know, I don't know that I've made a whole lot of specific resolutions this year, other than, like, don't eat your feelings so much, and, but I really do think that, like, I mean, I haven't, like, made any kind of, you know, resolutions on, like, what I want to see in my inbox. Mm-hmm. I think we had a question about, you know, what our manuscript wish list is. I don't think I have any specific sort of prescriptions for that. But what I do want to make sure is that, like, all my clients are as much of a success as I can make them. Mm-hmm. Because if the new administration only respects money, I'm going to fucking make as much of it as I can.
Yeah.
And then they can't fucking ignore me, you know? Like, yeah. I think that that's sort of, you know, I, who knows if I can actually do that? And who knows, like, because I can't actually control that. But, like, I can control, like, how much work I put in. And, like, I think I allowed myself to get too paralyzed by, like, how fucking upset I was about the election.
Yes.
And so
I think the other thing is that it is very easy for us to view our jobs as taking care of other people.
Yeah.
Like, I am fighting for my clients. Like, I am not just doing this for, like, some faceless organization. I am working on behalf of, like, real people I know.
Yeah.
And I think that that makes it very, it makes it more tangible.
Well, and also, like, I think that the fact that, you know, I'm able to make a living doing what I'm sure many people on the right would think of as frivolous nonsense, the fact that I'm like, no, this is an actual valid job. Like, the creation of art is a valid job. And for both the people who are making the art and the people who are helping people make the art.
Yep.
And everything I do in service of my clients is, and I have to, like, remind myself of that, because I'm not always good at it. I'm not always good at reminding myself to, like, you know, respond to things on time, you know? Like, I say this with the full knowledge that, like, I owe many people many emails. But, like, it's important to recognize that, like, even when I don't want particularly to engage, it is important for me to. Mm. And if I sort of, like, tell myself that, it's actually easier to kind of, like, it's like playing, you know, that sort of, like, thrilling Captain America music, and imagining that what you're doing is, like, punching Hydra agents.
Like, this audio deal is going to be great.
this contract negotiation is my bitch. Yes. So that wasn't really particularly coherent, but like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have some questions on the Tumblrs. One of them from Tony Starkulous, which is a great name. Good job.
Yes, good job.
Good job, person. Do you guys have an ETA date for the Vor game? I'm eager to hear what you think about it.
Not today. Jinx.
Hey. So this month, I think. Or yeah. Actually, probably not this month, but like early next month, because it's nearly.
We are.
Yeah.
Nearly halfway
but
yeah.
But we'll be talking
month.
About sort of the Warrior's Apprentice Part 2, because I have now almost finished it instead of stopping.
Yes.
My feelings have not changed that much. we'll be able to read that one and Vorgame and Setaganda. So we'll be able to talk about three of them at once.
Oh, exciting.
And so not today, but thank you for asking, and we really appreciate it.
We're very glad that people are actually reading these along with us.
Yeah, and feel free to, you know, even if it takes us a while to actually get to discussing them on an episode, feel free to send us your thoughts, like either via an email or
absolutely
in a Tumblr ask, because we would, you know, love to hear about it.
Yeah.
Another question from A Cool Shades Anon says, how do you feel about sites like Inkshares, which I'm not really that familiar with?
I do not know that one.
One of my friends had a book published with them and has encouraged me to look into that to get my book out there. At first, I was enthusiastic. Crowdfunding, editors, help with marketing. But after reading a book's published there that weren't so great, I'm a bit more leery of the platform. I'm curious to see how it would be viewed if mentioned in a query letter to an agent. So I guess it's like a crowdfunding...
Yeah. My, I sort of hissed. I don't know if you heard that over. That's the kind of thing that if that is what you choose to do, I'm sort of like, if you want to self-publish and do it right. If you don't want to self-publish, if you want to work with a publisher, don't put it out into the world at all before you approach agents.
So it looks like this is sort of a little bit like Swoon Reads, where authors share the crowd funds we publish is their slogan.
Okay.
So,
but like at least Swoon Reads is backed by Macmillan.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, one of my clients' books is being published by Swoon Reads and it comes out in February. It's called Traveler and it is so fucking good.
Awesome.
Ellie Delano. It's really great.
Nice.
Comes out in like, oh my God, like 3 weeks. Very soon. Build your readership, sell pre-orders, we publish your book. I mean...
Maybe?
Honestly, like, I feel sort of about this the way I feel about self-publishing. Like,
yeah.
If that's where you want to go, great. But, like, maybe don't have this be your first.
Yeah. I don't do that in order to get an agent's attention.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
You're shooting yourself in the foot. That is... the opposite of what agents want to see. If it's if you published a previous book through them, then it's a lot more neutral.
Yeah.
I'm sort of like, okay, you did that thing and now you want to do something else. That's fine. But if you publish a book through them and then approach agents with the same book,
we can't do anything with it. Yeah. Unless it was such a runaway success that
a publisher has approached you with interest.
Or, you know, I mean, honestly, like there are agents who make a very good living going through the self-published, you know, Amazon stuff, you know, going through sites like this, going through Wattpad and finding those people. And, you know, honestly, like, I feel like those people are doing such a good job that if I get approached by someone who hasn't already been approached by someone like that, you know, I'm just like, well, what could I do that one of those agents couldn't do with this particular book? What could I do that Amazon has not already done?
Yeah.
You know? So I would say that, like, give your writing the best chance it can through whatever medium you choose. Yeah. If that means you're querying to an agent, go hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, work as hard as you can on your book. You know, find an agent or, you know, try to find an agent. If you want to self-publish, fine. Great.
Yep. Go for
Mazel tov.
Just do the thing that you want to do as well as you can.
Yeah.
If you're really serious about being an author... if you just want to write as a hobby, that is also totally fine. You can do whatever you want. Then you can just...
Do you think that anyone actually does write for a hobby, though, these days? I genuinely don't think that anyone does.
Well, I suppose most of the people who do are sort of fandom adjacent. Because, like, I wrote fanfic as a hobby. I didn't intend for that to go anywhere.
But people who write, like, original early, yeah. you know, non fan works.
I don't know. Maybe people do.
I feel like I get all those queries though.
I know.
Because I feel like people who write, I mean, maybe this is just being, maybe this is not being very generous towards authors, but I feel like unlike other pursuits, which I feel like can have, like you can learn to play the guitar and like play the guitar for someone.
I'm an extremely amateur fiddler.
Exactly. But like,
I do not expect to get paid ever.
Exactly. But like, I feel like for writers, they think that the only sort of natural outcome of pursuing that as a hobby is to get paid.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's especially because it's not really something you can do communally.
Yeah.
Like I can go to this amateur fiddling session and play with other people and it can be a really good time even though I'm not very good at it.
Yeah. And you can be in like RP groups or like, you know, writing forums and stuff, but it's not the same as.
Yeah. Writing in and of itself is a very isolated activity.
Yeah.
But, you know, in case you are listening and you would like to be a hobby writer, that is totally fine.
100%.
You can do whatever you want with your writing in that case.
Yeah.
If you would like to be a professional, you can't treat it like a hobby.
Yeah.
You have to treat it like a profession.
And you can't be surprised if the thing that you thought was going to be super easy, like signing up for crowdfunding or self-publishing your book, you can't be surprised if that does not turn out as well as you thought it would.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, honestly, like, when you think about self-publishing, it's just like, here's a list of all the things you're going to have to do. That otherwise Macmillan would pay someone to do, you know, or Hachette or
someone.
Tin House or whoever, you know, it's someone's job to do that.
They have specific people they pay money to do that for. And so either you have to do it or you have to pay someone to do it.
Yeah. So that was a great question. First, she had a second question was any thoughts on the book deal for He Who Must Not Be Named and what it says about the publishing industry.
We must name him, Jen. You just can't pronounce it, can you?
Yiannopoulos?
That's what I think, too. Milo?
Any thoughts on that douchebag's book deal and what it says about publishing industry / what we can do? I mean,
what it says about publishing is that publishers want to make money.
Yeah. And honestly, like, I sort of feel the same way about that as I do about my making money, is that, like, if Simon & Schuster can make money off of this cretin's fans... Yeah. A, I will be surprised, and B, I know that that money will be funneled into...
They're going to pirate that book. They're not going to pay for it.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that... I mean, as Connor pointed out, some Nazi think tank will buy it by the... you know, buy That's one fair. In the name of every single one of its supporters. But but I think, you know, similar to how, you know, Random House publishing 50 Shades of Grey allowed it to acquire Penguin and then give all of its employees a raise.
Yeah.
You know...
Yeah, the year that Random House published 50 Shades of Grey, in case you don't know this, they gave every single one of their employees...
From the warehouse up.
Yeah. Like, top executives down to the warehouse, every person who had worked there for at least a year got a $5,000 Christmas bonus.
They called it the 50 Shades bonus.
Yeah.
Because like, they all knew.
They all knew what it was coming from.
So, like, you know, obviously that is, like, terrible blood money if it came from this. But at the same time, like, Simon & Schuster has, like, a Muslim YA imprint.
Yes.
You know, they publish incredible books by a number of incredible people.
Or are going to, because they haven't come out yet. But that it proves that Simon & Schuster is also investing in this. They want to build that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very sort of, like... You know, the thing about publishing is that it's not a neutral activity.
Yeah.
Like, it is not, as much as we would like it to be sort of like rainbows and puppies and niceness to everybody, it is an industry that needs to make money. And unfortunately, people with views that we find repugnant have money to spend on books.
Yeah. And I'm not even going to get into the free speech issue because, like, of
course... No, that's nonsense.
It's irrelevant. Of course, he has the right to write a book and... But publishers reject people every single day for various reasons.
And there was several excellent articles on the internet talking to other publishers on, like, no. You know, his whole narrative is like, I didn't even want a book, and Simon & Schuster approached me. It's like, no, he went around, like, knocking at the door of every single publisher.
And lots of people turned him down.
I'm like, really? For as fancy as he thinks he is, $250,000 is not that much, and he's never going to earn out.
That's not real famous people money.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think even, like, Kim Kardashian got paid more for her, like, selfie book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for her. Oh. I love her. I've come around to the Kim Kardashian love. I'm just like, you're great.
Yeah, and there was, I will say, one of my clients has been published by Simon & Schuster, and she wrote this wonderful, really thoughtful middle grade novel that is literally about a boy learning to have empathy for the girls around him. And that's
is
not,
that
The Last Boy at St. Edith's?
Last Boy at St. Edith's, yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And it's also a really fun, funny book that boys will read and be very happy to read and not realize that they're also ingesting a lesson. But it's that's what it's about. And there are a lot of great people at Simon & Schuster who are working to tell stories like that.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to understand the structure of publishing companies, where, like, the larger leadership at Simon & Schuster and, like, the larger body of people who work there are very distinct from, like, the people who work on the conservative imprint. And also, honestly, like, I know someone who works on the one of the conservative imprints at Harper, and they're just like, I have no control over what I have to read for work. Like, this is just my job.
Yeah.
And, like,
it's like, I have to make this book as good as possible. I don't have to agree with it.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it's very sort of facile to say, like, well, you should protest. Like, well, you know,
that's
nobody
nice,
in publishing makes any money. Like, it be nice.
Yeah.
To be able to protest that way. But in publishing, unless you have a trust fund.
Yep.
You know, maybe these people do. Maybe, you know.
Maybe they do. Maybe the people who work at conservative imprints do. But, yeah. Yeah, the other thing is the people who want to protest Simon & Schuster as a whole are, you know, they're protesting a lot of really great, thoughtful, diverse books.
Yeah.
And Threshold Books is this, like, one tiny imprint. And the other thing is, if you're going to boycott Threshold Books, we were never the market anyway.
Yeah, they don't care.
They don't care if we don't like it. If we don't like it and we complain about it a lot, their audience is like, oh, liberal,
I mean,
tears, I must buy this book.
Not to, like, compare it to, like, the Montgomery bus bike boycott, which was, like, an actual important historical thing that happened, but, like, a boycott is only vital if it's boycotting money you would have spent.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I was never going to buy this book.
I was never
going
to buy
it. They're not going to be mad
we
that
weren't,
I'm still not
we weren't
going to
buy that
it.
Book. And, you know, a boycott is only good if it's the only place you can get that thing, too.
Yeah.
You know, like, the bus boycott was like, there's one bus provider in the city of Montgomery, Alabama.
Yeah.
And we're not going to take it.
Yeah.
We're not going to do it. And so it was really effective because they lost an ass load of money.
Mm-hmm.
But if a bunch of people are just like, I'm not going to buy any Simon & Schuster books, it's not like you can't get books elsewhere. Like, the publishing industry as a whole is not going to, like, suffer from a boycott of Simon & Schuster books. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And The other thing, which I actually tweeted about, I think the only sort of viable protest that is going to make any sort of difference is if people have friends or relatives who actually buy the kinds of books that Threshold Books publishes.
Mm-hmm.
And they can go, because a lot of people are conservative and are also really horrified by the turn
because
that this party has taken.
Yeah.
And so if those people go and say, we will not stand for this, this is not what our politics are about.
Well, and I think that this is circling back to some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier about how easy it's been to sort of not engage.
Yeah.
You know, I forget who said it, but someone was like, yeah, it would have been super helpful for you to talk, you know, so there were all those think pieces about, like, how to talk to your conservative relatives at Thanksgiving dinner, and someone was like, you know, one would have
done that a month before,
or like last Thanksgiving, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the time, you know, if someone's like, on Fox News they talked about this book by this fella, do you think I should read it, you know, because people are gonna ask that. My relatives are like, hey, publishing person,
yeah,
what do you think about this book? My aunt, actually, I found when I was cleaning out my room at home in Houston, I found this awesome copy of, like, the article from Vanity Fair about The Art of Fielding. So she had, like, photocopied and sent to me. I was like, I forgot that she had done that. It was so cool. But, like, you know, you have relatives in publishing. They're probably interested in about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can probably explain to them, like, or if they know you're a reader.
Yeah.
You know.
Or a writer.
Exactly, you know.
That's the only way, like, they really do not care if the rest of us aren't interested.
Yeah.
Like, I also did not buy Bill O'Reilly's books.
I know. Bless. But
I think that a boycott isn't going to work, no. And our complaints are also not going to work. I feel like this is the sort of thing where we should stop talking about it, in all honesty. So let's stop talking about it.
Yeah. Your client, Tracy Townsend, asked, books with plots that are political in an intelligent / exciting way, asking for my friend 2017. my sister reread The Handmaid's Tale over Christmas break and was like, oh, God.
The Handmaid's Tale.
I mean, the thing about The Handmaid's Tale is that, like, I don't, you know, as much as, you know, we sort of say, like, oh, my God, it's true. The real truth of, like, what would happen if we allow things to get as far as they might get. It's not going to be sort of like ladies in red, like sexual slavery. It's just going to be like a slow, like, it's going to be like lines at the doctor and like expensive birth control. And like, it's going to be a lot of insidious, small tragedies rather than like one big.
It's not all going to be overthrown.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not going to happen. Yeah. But
yeah, I guess Hope Was Here by Joan Bauer is really great.
I mean, I feel like, you know, the personal is political. So, you know, I find it hard not to read a book and think of the political overtones. I mean, one thing that kept coming to mind, especially when I was home, was the book A Stricken Field by Martha Gellhorn. It was like one of her novels. And it's about a woman who is a reporter in. So, yeah, it actually, I was right. It is about a reporter in Prague who is there and is sort of dealing with the sort of refugee population of the city who are trying to get out before the Germans really start fucking shit up. The Nazis, I should say. that's what I keep thinking about. And then I read The Face of War before Christmas. And she, one of the articles was from, you know, reporting from Germany, you know, after the war. Mm-hmm. She's like, it's very surprising to me how few people here are Nazis. Everyone keeps coming up to me and being like, you know, I just disagreed with everything they did. And she's like, sure, Jan. Yes. Sure.
Right.
So I think about that a lot, you know.
Yeah. I do also think it's really interesting, since all of our tweets are archived in the Library of Congress.
Also, isn't the Library of Congress lady, like, she's like the FBI director where, like, they can't depose her, right?
No, she's for life.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes me so happy. Right? All those tweets about that cute little, like, librarian for the day who had read, like, 1,000 books. I was like, God, her, like, little pink dress.
I wanted to squeeze her cheeks. Oh, my God.
And the way that they were, like, walking down the hall.
Proud.
Like,
I was so,
I may or may not have cried at work reading that story.
Sorry. Little girls who love books are, like,
oh, my God. And she was wearing this cute little pink dress. And she had big hair. Oh, my God. She was so cute. Oh.
And she was so, she was like, she was clearly so proud to be there.
When she was like at the desk, like,
yes. Oh my God. You're the best.
Oh my God. No one in this room is crying right now.
Nope, definitely not.
Can I just kill this? Is that fine?
Give me a little bit more.
Fine, you can kill it.
Oh, well, our tweets are archived. And so, like, there's going to be a record of the people who vociferously protested and the people who just kind of quietly let it happen.
Or the people who, in, you know, I always find it fascinating when there are these stories about people getting fired because people find out that online they've been, like, hideous trolls.
Oh, yeah.
Like that teacher who was like, you know who I hate? Black people. Yes. You know? And they're like, I don't know why you thought we wouldn't find this.
Yeah.
I don't know why you thought that this would go away forever.
Yeah.
But,
the response I was going to have to the question is, you know, extremely predictable, but right at the end of the year I read Mouse.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
which was, I confess, partly because it was very short and a graphic novel and I could read it quickly and I was really behind on my Goodreads challenge, but also it was amazing. And so that is one
of those... your first time reading it?
Yeah. I bought it years ago. He came to my school and gave a talk, and it was, you know, one of those talks that you cannot get tickets to. It was just, like, there were 500 tickets and 5,000 people who wanted to go. This is like Barack Obama gave a talk at my school when I was a freshman, and this was after he had given the speech at
the
convention, but before he was running for president. And it was still, I was like, I have no idea who this guy is. And also I would have to go wait in a line for 3 hours to potentially get a ticket to see this guy. So like, why am I going to do this? And then 2 years later, he's running for president. I'm like, oh,
fuck my life.
Damn it. So I bought Mouse because it was a signed copy at my university bookstore. And I was like, I should get this. Like, I should read this anyway. Like, I'm interested in it. And so I've been carrying it around for years. So finally I was like, this is right here. It's short. It's timely. And I would like to read it anyway. So I read that just like sitting on my bed in an hour and a half. And so that was, you know, also fascinating. And it's a slightly different perspective from your usual Holocaust novels, because it's a man who, or a mouse, who is targeted but doesn't actually get sent to the concentration camps for a very long time.
Yeah.
And so it's all about how he's surviving in this city that where he's like hiding and moving from place to place, and how he is carrying on and trying to live.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned it before Christmas, but Eichmann in Jerusalem I thought was really good. It's the book that introduced the phrase the banality of evil.
Oh.
And I think that, you know, even though it's framed around this trial that was like very sensational, like it was very useful in talking about like the way that this kind of thing is created, at least in like a professionalized atmosphere. But I think that the most important thing, like, honestly, like, regardless of whether or not you think that the plot is actually political, reading whatever you can in this day and age is almost a political act, because you are consuming stories that are not your story.
Yes.
It is a way of looking outside yourself.
Reading things that, I mean, honestly, what I was saying before the janitors came in, is reading things. I mean, this goes back to what I want to do, but reading things that are just stories from people who are not like you is a political act.
But
in this
I mean,
day and
honestly,
age.
Even if the, you know, the hero or heroine of the book is exactly like you in every way, it is still not you.
That's
you know,
true.
I feel like even if the person you read about resembles you in every kind of superficial way, it is still not a story that you are telling to yourself.
That's true.
Because I feel like the narratives that we have inside our heads can be very insidious in a lot of ways, especially in times of, like, stress. You know, we tell ourselves, like, this is awful, there's nothing I can do, like, even if I do anything, it's garbage. Like,
yeah,
that all may be true, but, like, we won't know until later. And the more we sort of, like, read other people's stories, the better equipped we'll be to deal with whatever
and
happens.
That moment of reading a book and saying, oh, other people feel that way too. That's exactly how I feel. I thought I was the only one. That moment is so world expanding.
Yeah.
That it's definitely not something we can throw away in these days.
Yeah. So our last question on Twitter is about our current manuscript wish list / book to film thoughts. From Megan Eccles. I don't have any book to film thoughts.
No, sometimes
other
good,
than I would like Hollywood
bad.
To give me lots of
I
money.
I would like them to give me lots of money, yes.
Actually, give my clients lots of money that I can then take 15% of.
Yes.
My current manuscript wish list is just, I mean, I was joking to Perry today. I was like, would it be bad if I changed my, like, you know, requests online to, like, pornography? I'll know it when I see it. He was like, I mean, I agree with you, but yes, that would be bad. So, I mean, I'm looking for books that I, like, can't put down, basically.
I also, this is not a question, but it is a response to our previous episode from my client, Lee Jertson Malone.
Oh, great.
Who wrote The Last Boy at St. Edith's, which I was talking about earlier. She tweeted that she had some thoughts about crit partners who write different stuff. So I thought I would share those.
Yes, please do.
She says, first, finding a crit partner who you can really trust to give you honest feedback about your work is hard enough. Restricting by genre? Ugh. Second, genres, age groups can be their own bubble. You hear a lot of the same things, not that they were wrong, and you should listen. But there is a huge value to having someone who isn't in your specific bubble but is a great writer and gives good feedback read your work. Lots of people get very specific with crit partners, but I believe thinking broadly is better. Think mindset about writing, not genre. Ultimately, I want a crit partner who will tell me the worst, and we will still like each other after. And I don't like to read or crit books like mine when I'm writing, but I will crit something totally different. So, those are all Lee's thoughts on our comments about having crit partners who write different things from you.
I don't disagree with any of them.
No, certainly not. She's very smart. That's why I signed her.
Smarty pants. Well, on that note, what are you reading these days?
I am currently reading Sea Change by S.M. Wheeler.
Oh, I love that book.
Oh my God, I didn't know you'd read it.
Yeah, it was the tour book, right?
Yes.
The one about the Kraken.
Yes.
Yes.
It's about a girl who.
I gave that to a friend of mine and I was like, I love this book. And she's like, thanks. I was like, no, you're going to love it. I still do not know if she's ready.
I have had it on my shelf for years and I finally actually picked it up and read it. And it's wonderful so far. I love it. I love the voice. I love the style. It's very fairy tale-esque. And I was sort of like, oh, this is almost YA. And then there's this scene where a troll takes her uterus. And I was like, oh, this is not YA.
I got to that point and I was just like, am I high right now?
I was like, holy
I'd like
shit.
Put the book aside a couple days and then like come back to it and be like, oh, no, that actually
that
happened.
That was real.
That happened in this book.
So, yeah, it's like very sort of YA and then it gets real intense. And then it sort of goes back to being very fairy tale-esque and just like dealing with some things, but it's really interesting. It's very well done. And apparently she was a teenager when she wrote it. And I'm just like,
what
I'm
the fuck?
Sorry. What?
What?
So yeah, I highly recommend that. What are you reading, Jen?
Well, I'm sort of in the middle of a couple of things. I'm obviously in the middle or nearly to the end of rereading or of finishing The Warrior's Apprentice, which I have some thoughts on, but we can get to that later.
We'll save those for next time.
I'm also reading a book that I got for Christmas that I actually asked for, and everyone that I've told this to has made fun of me deeply. It is the book The Romanovs by Simon Sebag Montefiore.
Nice.
It's a history of the Romanov dynasty.
Nice.
It's good. It is very interesting, but he doesn't have a lot of kind of like, there's a lot of sort of like, now this guy, and now this guy, and now this guy, which in some cases works, but as sort of like, so far he has not really done a great job of like placing people within the larger dynasty. Like I have a hard time keeping track of like where we are.
Yeah. Especially when people have the same names, which they often do.
Alexei. Everyone is fucking named Alexei.
Yes.
Ivan the Terrible. A Romanov.
Alexei? Oh, no.
He was a Romanov,
okay.
Yeah, apparently.
I don't know.
Hopefully I read that right and didn't just like, I don't know.
Didn't just make that up.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff where I'm just like, what? There was like a whole, oh my God, I wish I had the book on me so I could tell you. It was, there was a period of time where there were like three, Ivan. There was a period of time where like, I think it was Ivan. There was like a brother who died and they called it like the time of the false Ivans. Because there was like three guys who all pretended to be like the dead prince, and he like kept like raising armies.
It's like the movie Anastasia, but real.
But like real, and in like 1600, and everything was like terrible and garbage, and they were fighting Poland like all the time.
Oh my God!
And so like at one point, the like I think it was the false Ivans. I'm gonna like check it, but it was just like at one point, one of them raised an army from Poland, and then at one point, one of them raised an army from Sweden, and you're just like, what?
Sidebar, I think a lot these days about how people are going to treat our time in the history books. Like, 3 or 4 years ago, I didn't think about that at all.
Oh, I think about it a lot.
But I thought about how archaeologists were going to view our lives. But now I'm like, oh, this is going to be one of those years where everything went to hell, isn't
My
it?
My friend Kendra tweeted something about, like, imagine being, like, an AP US history student in the year, like, 2040 and reading this document as part of, like, the AP US history exam.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
There are going to be a lot of 17-year-olds freaking out.
Can you imagine teaching this in U.S.? I mean, it's amazing, but so I'm reading that, and I'm, you know, I'm like, yeah, I've got a lot of stuff sort of on the back burner. I also went like ham in Houston buying books because the half price books across the street.
Ham? I'm sorry, you went ham?
Hard as a motherfucker.
Okay, I have never heard that before. Thanks for teaching me.
I bought Swing Time by Zadie Smith. Ooh, I bought The Mothers by Britt Bennett. I bought the new Maria Semple.
Oh, I want to read that.
I literally realized I gave Where'd You Go Bernadette to like 3 people this year for Christmas.
I gave Where'd You Go Bernadette to my mother for Christmas, and I was like, she's either going to love this or
hate
this. I
was joking to everybody that I feel like an evangelist. Like, have you heard the gospel of Where'd You Go Bernadette?
I feel like this about Miss Fisher. Have you heard the gospel of Miss Fisher?
But I loved Where'd You Go Bernadette so much. I think it's that, so like, good. If I think about books that I, like, unreservedly loved from 2016... I would say that Where'd You Go Bernadette was like at
you
the top.
You hadn't read it? Did you read it because I told you to?
Well, I remember you like flailing about it, and then I think I picked it up, and then I was like, oh, I'll read this.
And it's so good.
It's so good. I remember.
I didn't expect it to be that good either, but it is.
Well, I expected it to be good, but I didn't expect it to be the kind of good that I would love.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly had this attitude about books that are published that, like, probably they're readable.
Yes. You know?
Probably they're readable and have something good about them. It might not be the thing that I love that, like, keeps me coming back to books.
But it's probably fine.
Yeah. But then I was reading it. I was just like, I hope no one is, like, hearing me cackling alone in my apartment. Like, woo! I think that the mudslide is where I just fucking lost it. I, like, couldn't even... Like, and I hadn't really seen it coming. I was just like, well, something ridiculous is going to happen as a result of this. Just like, oh my God, right? The structural integrity of, like, hillsides. Like, what the fuck? So anyway, so I bought those 3, and then I got, like, a bunch of stuff that I hadn't read at the Half Price Books 20% off sale, and then I went to Brazos Books and bought a ton of stuff, and also bought myself a retractable fountain pen because... Why not?
Obviously. Before we close out, I would like to mention that our wine tonight...
Oh, yes!
Which was delicious. Which was delicious.
Fogg's Ranch.
Pinot Noir from Fogg's Ranch.
By Jay Lohr.
Yes. It was a gift from my boss's client, Anna Shinoda.
Who I believe gave us our 2016...
Yes! She's incredibly generous. She's also a lovely person and has written a wonderful book. Her book... that was out a couple of years ago. It's called Learning Not to Drown. I highly recommend
it. Last year.
It was a few years ago.
Oh, but we talked about
it. We talked about it last year.
It's still good.
It's still a good book. It's still great. And she's, you know, working on new stuff, and I'm very excited to read her next book because my boss says it's very good. And so I highly recommend checking her out because not only is she a very generous wine donor, she's a lovely person and a good author. So
next time I'll bring a bottle of wine that Mer Lafferty.
Oh, there we go.
Whose book?
And we could talk about how great she is.
Yes. Well, I'm just going to put it in a plug for 6 weeks, which comes out on January 31st. It's great.
Excellent.
I love my job.
I know, right? How lucky are we?
How lucky we are to be alive right now.
Except I'm not 100% sure that's true anymore.
But, I mean, I have to feel that, like, you know, for people that were, like, in the 13 colonies who also didn't have penicillin,
still better off than them.
We don't have smallpox.
That's true.
We eradicated smallpox as a country. As a civilization, you know? Like,
it's true. For pretty much my entire life, whenever people have said things like, how could you possibly have children now? I'm like, now is a better time to have children than the entire past.
I'm not going to die
it's
in childbirth,
like
most likely.
It's the best time in the entire history of the human species. But suddenly...
In the West.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's... Yes.
In industrialized Western countries.
Yes. When you know... United States citizens say to me, oh, the world is so terrible. How could you have children now? I'm like,
Check your privilege, bitch.
You're not going to die, and your child's probably not going to die. Like,
let's talk about Venezuela. And on that note, thank you so much for listening. We had a really great year last year. I think that our average monthly download rate was like 1,500 downloads per month.
A positive of 2016.
There
are definitely some.
But, you know, thank you so much for sticking with us.
We really appreciate it.
If there's anything that you want us to tackle in 2017, if you want us to do more political talk, if you have books that you desperately want us to read that we don't have on our radar, please let us know.
If there are any burning questions about how to be a writer, how to get published, any of those things, and, you know... We would like to be considered for the Hugo for Best Fan Cast.
Yes,
so
we would.
So if you'd like to...
We actually genuinely would like
to
be considered
for that. Yeah,
that
would be
great.
So... I would love that. Especially if we get to go to Helsinki.
I mean, I'm going, so...
I am not at this point, but if I had a reason to go, I would. So if there's anything particularly SFF-related that you would like us to talk about, we can definitely do so. Just... Give us a holler, Twitter, Tumblr, email, all of those things work for us. And we are always happy to answer your questions.
Thank you so much for sticking with us. And we wish you nothing but the best of success and health and happiness and revolution and, you know, power and might in 2017.
Yes.
So, bye.